Welcome to Cisflix, the podcast where we won't judge you for talking through the movie. Cisflix are the movies you laugh at, yearn for, and overanalyze with your girls, significant others, and now us.
We are your hosts,
Paola
and Nadja, two sisters and designers who discuss chick flicks we hate to love,
tropes we love to hate,
and all of the aesthetic choices in between. Join us as we break down our favorite movies together. Hi guys, here's Nadja with a quick caveat. I had a little bit of audio trouble as we were recording, so I wanted you guys to know before you get into it. It's going to sound a little bit different. Definitely still intelligible, but sounds a little bit more like you're talking to me on the phone than listening to me on a fancy schmancy podcast. So if that's offensive to you, I'm so sorry. We fix it in the next episode. But yeah, just wanted to let you know.
All right, we're getting into episode 3, The Art of the Swoon. So we start the episode by Daphne dreaming of the Duke. And again, Daphne is a total stranger to her own sexuality and how her body works. So all her mind does is just replay the Duke touching her back
and slipping her glove off. And this is something they continue to repeat throughout their relationship, is this slipping of the glove and then almost kiss in this dream. Ooh, girl.
Daphne and Simon spend more time together. They get ice cream. They go to another ball. And
can I ask you a question, though? Have you ever wanted to be a spoon? They didn't need to show the Duke making out with the spoon.
Yes, they did.
Did they, though? You know what? Actually, you're right. They did us all a service because,
I'm unable.
If you scream, I scream. And we all scream. I'm so sorry.
No, you're not. What the hell?
They didn't need to do all that, but they did. And we're all grateful. Also, did you know that the ice cream shop was actually a real ice cream shop that existed at the time and when it's like super popular for the time? Gunter's Tea Shop.
That's really cool.
The spoons there are delicious, I hear.
Well, you could just lick them up and down. Right, so Daphne and Simon spend more time together, and as they spend more time together, Daphne kind of starts to realize that she does have feelings, like lusty ones, for the Duke, ones that she doesn't necessarily understand about herself that kind of confuse her. We also learn, again, the queen is this figure who is like very bored. Not only does she demand attention and adoration, she also demands excitement and interest, and nothing that's happening on the marriage mart that she so carefully pulls puppet strings on and orchestrates is interesting to her anymore. Daphne and the Duke courting, it's taking too long. Either someone needs to propose or they're not getting married. She decides to throw a wrench into shit by having her nephew visit and mingle in with the young ladies and nobility of the town. Her nephew, the Prince of Prussia, is added to the mix. Now he's in town. And now the fun that Charlotte is trying to have is matchmaking him with her diamond of the season, Daphne Bridgerton.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And there are reasons that this show has won the Emmy for like costumes and hair and makeup, because just Queen Charlotte's wigs are Emmy worthy, Golden Globe worthy.
No, and something I love that they do is the wigs and the hair. Like, not only is this cast diverse, the way they celebrate and showcase different hair textures, natural hair textures throughout
all the makeup and all the wardrobe on this show. And not all of the wardrobe is like super duper true to the period because they're taking lots of artistic license, but for the most part it is.
The basic structures of the dresses are. Mm-hmm. The color palettes are definitely
brighter.
Modernized.
Correct.
You know, I don't know that you could get these bright dyes.
You couldn't.
In this age, yeah, no, you couldn't.
Yeah. Bright color like that only started to exist after the invention of synthetic fibers.
Exactly. Which was what? Early 19th century?
Late 1860s, 1870s, I want to say. That's when people started wearing like bright pink, like Featherington colors. That's when people started wearing those. Totally. So Simon and Anthony are tentatively back on good terms. They're still a little bit shaky since Simon is kind of courting Anthony's sister. He doesn't tell Anthony about their quote-unquote fake dating arrangement, their ruse. He's very much in the dark about the true nature of their relationship. I think it keeps them from going back to being the close friends that they once were when they were at school.
Well, it keeps the tension, it for does. Sure.
Yeah.
Because in the books, Anthony knows. They let him know off the bat because he gets too aggressive.
Well, Anthony in the books, people shit on Anthony in the show. Anthony in the books is a fucking nightmare. He's a fucking really nightmare. The changes that they made to his character for the show, I'm like, yes, snaps. Golden Globes for everyone, because this man in the book is horrible.
Oh, he's so annoying.
Yeah, he is. He's the worst. So going from Anthony and the Duke being on slightly better terms, other things kind of go south for Anthony when he is dumped by his opera singing soprano girlfriend, Sienna. Here we also see that after, you know, Anthony has this bad interaction with Sienna and Daphne is kind of reeling from her interactions with the Duke, they have this kind of late night chat in their home where both of them are kind of up late at night, unable to sleep. And they finally are able to, like, have a bit more of a transparent talk with each other rather than Anthony just being, like, an asshole all the time. And Daphne just kind of asks him, like, what was Simon's life like? How did you guys know each other? What was he like? And Anthony doesn't tell her in detail because no one tells women anything in detail on the show. But he says his life was really different from ours. We love our parents. Our parents loved us. They loved each other. He didn't have that. Like, he didn't really know his father. He grew up spending tons of time alone, and you know what? I think that's how he prefers it. Wrong answer. But that he spent tons of time alone is the truth. So Daphne's left kind of wondering about that.
I believe either the next day or within the next couple of days, they go to an art exhibition at Somerset House. Here, we're surrounded by art. Again, I love a feminist moment. We get this moment where Eloise and Penelope are presenting the way that women are painted in these portraits. Eloise makes a comment. These were obviously all painted by men who see women as mere decorative objects. And we're talking about paintings in the Regency era where women quite literally look like porcelain dolls. This visit at this exhibition at Somerset House kind of plays out the way we see the balls play out throughout the episodes, where you're kind of touching base with multiple storylines at the same time. We see that Marina is back into society. Mrs. Featherington is trying to get her quickly engaged. She's introducing her to a bunch of old guys who just want to get married to have an heir. We see Lady Danbury is walking around with a gentleman. And now they put Lady Danbury in these amazing hats. I love seeing her in the top hats.
It's literally like Cher in that one interview where she's like, you know, my mother keeps telling me that I need to marry a rich man. And I just tell her, Mom, I am a rich man.
Yes, that's Lady Danbury. Yes. 100%. She's walking around with a gentleman. She comes across Benedict, who's looking at a painting. And Benedict just goes off and starts to critique this painting with Lady Danbury. Lady Danbury happens to be right next to the artist, Mr. Granville.
Let's Benedict make a full ass of himself in front of this man.
He's like, trágame tierra. He just wants the earth to open up and just swallow him. Oh, ooh, wow, that sounded weird. I'm swallow so sorry me. About that. You can take that out.
I won't. No, I won't.
Please do. And then on the other end,
Daphne has a brief conversation with the prince. She sees Simon kind of lurking in the background. She follows him. They end up in this one gallery by themselves. Ooh, scandal. But they're kind of still in public, I guess, so maybe it's not bad. So they end up in this gallery by themselves full of paintings that the Duke of Hastings has donated from his private collection. They both start standing in front of this one painting, this like kind of simple looking sunrise composition. And he mentions offhandedly, you know, this was one of my mother's favorites. I don't really know why, but I didn't know her. So I'm just told that this was one of her favorites. And Daphne kind of starts to do like a little art history major analysis on this painting and how it makes her feel, the peace and serenity of like the composition and da da da. It leads to them having a very intimate moment where they touch hands.
They touch hands. And this, ladies and gentlemen, is why we're here.
For the hand touching. Burr, 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 burr. Yeah, these are the same two bitches that sat through Pride and Prejudice, where no one kisses until the end. So.
But the hand flex, Naja, come on now.
Poor Matthew McFadden. Like, he's going to carry that for the rest of his life.
That was the tension.
So we go from this art exhibition to the entire town seeming to simultaneously decide to promenade along the Thames, just hanging out everyone together, I guess. It's just an occasion to see and be seen.
In this scene, he wears one of my favorite outfits that I see on him. Mm-hmm. You don't see him wear a lot of color. Mm-hmm.
He wears lots of black.
Especially in the first few scenes that you see him in, he's wearing all black.
And I guess he's technically in mourning.
Technically, I guess. Because his father just died. Maybe. Yeah, but even the Lady Danbury is like, you know, why are you wearing all this black? Like, your style is so monotonous. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Or you're starting to feel as monotonous as the London season or whatever. And he's like, oh, I heard this color's in fashion. Jokingly, sarcastically, mm-hmm. anyway. Mm-hmm. But then he starts to wear more color. And the first colors that he starts to introduce into his wardrobe is red, which is like ends up representing him. But also we associate with Lady Danbury.
Yes.
So I feel like maybe it's just tying them together. But in this scene, he wears almost all red, where he has like this dark red jacket. Mm-hmm. The vest under it is also a dark red with like, I think, gold embellishments or something. His cravat is also this deep red color. And the only thing he's wearing that's not red is this brooch. And this is the first time I noticed it. It's like an emerald brooch. It used to belong to his mom.
Aww.
He wears it throughout the whole season. But I guess I didn't notice it because it's always on like a dark backdrop. Mm-hmm. Seeing it against this red in this scene is what caught my eye. And I was like, oh, what is that? He wears his mother's brooch anytime you see him. And I think that speaks so much to who he is, like who you find out he is as you learn more about him. He's actually like a soft boy deep down. Oh, it's so sad.
Yeah. So as they're going on this promenade, Duke and Daphne walk. And why does she bring up the intimacy between a man and a woman?
So they're just walking and she's like, you know, my mom said something funny the other day. She said that your best match is like your dearest friend or something like that. Mm-hmm. And he's like, okay. And she's like, do you believe that? Like, what do you think about that? And he's like, yeah, you know, like it definitely helps to have that foundation. And she's like, yeah, but there must be like something more though. I feel like something intangible, but maybe tangible. Mm-hmm. And then that's where he's like, yeah, kind of, yeah, both. And she's like, but how? And then, yeah.
Yeah.
That's how they get into that conversation.
Yeah. So continuing like from that conversation, he pretty much talks to her about like physical intimacy, like the fact that outside of this companionship and friendship that she can find in marriage, that it also brings a physical connection that is quote unquote pleasurable. So Daphne is like so fucking in the dark. She has no idea what he's talking about. And I mean, I understand what we're watching, but at the same time, I'm like the inner pro, like this guy would have gotten fucking shot if someone found out what he's like telling Daphne
to do. If anybody heard what he was saying, for sure.
Oh my God. He must really trust her. So he's basically like, you know, if you want to know what I'm talking about, you should touch yourself at night between your legs.
Oh my God. Because she literally has no idea what he means. And then he gets the idea to say, oh, what happens between a man and a woman is like a continuation of what happens at night. She's like, at night? Like, what happens at night?
What? That's so weird. I'm asleep at night, you idiot.
He's like, no. Like, when you touch yourself during your private time?
And she's like,
what? And he's like, you don't touch yourself?
Yeah.
He's like, well, next time, I have a suggestion for you.
My God. Like, that must have split her brain in half. Like, oy.
I mean, she's been feeling these feelings. They're coming to her in dreams. She just doesn't know what to do with that.
Have I ever told you that your body comes back to me in dreams? That's from Red, White, and Royal Blue.
Wow.
I know.
Wow, Naja, look at that. I love this shift in our conversations lately where you casually bring up Nicholas Galantine.
I didn't bring him up at all.
Royal Blue.
I love that book. I love it. I'm the reason we covered the movie.
For sure. And I'm forever grateful to you.
Yeah, you've watched it 100 more times than I have.
Anyway, my bad.
Anywho.
Anywho's it.
During this promenade scene, Lady Danbury notices that the prince is interested in Daphne. He's peeping her. He's watching her. And Daphne's not paying attention to him, dude, because she likes the fucking Duke too much. And Cressida Cowper and her big-ass fucking forehead keep getting in front of the prince. So, after this promenade, Lady Danbury goes to Simon and she's like, yo, shit or get off the pot with Daphne.
100%.
Because there's a prince lurking around this hen house and you need to make up your fucking mind.
Get with it or get lost.
Exactly. We see Daphne taking Simon's advice. What was his advice, in case you forgot? It was to touch herself between her legs.
Quote, unquote.
Quote, unquote. So that following afternoon, Daphne goes to meet the Duke for a date at the ice cream shop so they can see and be seen. And the Duke is already acting like super fucking weird. It's pre-breakup. He says that his business in England is concluded, that he's going to leave. He's going to go back out and travel. She needs to, like, go find somebody else. And it leaves her super duper upset. Like, it is like a real breakup.
I almost feel sad for him here because you can see how reluctant he is to do that. But had Lady Danbury never said anything,
he wouldn't have. Yeah.
But then again, for how long though? You know what I mean?
Yeah, he was going to have to make up his mind at some point. And even if his mind was already made the whole time for him to not get married or whatever.
To like, not, right, exactly. He was enjoying his time with her. Lady Danbury made him realize he was in the way.
He was going to ruin her chances. And we're going to check in again on Marina. Lady Featherington tries to scare Marina straight by taking her to the Poe Potter Town. Pot of Town is what I said. And Marina's just like, listen, I'm just trying to hear back from my man. He's out in this war. And Lady Featherington is like, oh yeah, I bet he hasn't written back since you told him you were pregnant. Because that's how men are, you dumb bitch.
She got all of us wondering.
Gagged.
Like, oh, I mean, actually, he did not write back. You're right. Ooh.
Gagged. And we learn that Lady Featherington and her, like, crony, her henchman, who's her lady's maid, Mrs. Varley, forge a letter from George Crane to Marina, basically breaking things off with her. Like,
you handle your situation. I have nothing to do with that child that you're about to have.
And break Marina's heart. 100%. So Eloise and Benedict out at the house on Grosvenor Square. Something that I like about Eloise and Benedict's relationship is that they push each other. Since both of them are kind of this mindset of like, we feel like we don't really fit into this life. Eloise is like, you should do the stuff that you like to do. You should draw. If you like to draw, paint, if you like to paint. And she also constantly is reminding him, like, you can do whatever you want.
You're a man.
Mm-hmm. You're a man, and I'm not. And if I'm not allowed to do whatever the fuck I want, you're gonna do it for both of us. Whatever she says is enough pa que él se ponga la pila, for him to actually do something. The thing with Eloise is that even in spite of her understanding of herself as a woman with significantly less power and less heft than a man, she's still reading her fucking books, writing in her journal, talking shit about the state of the world, being annoying and being loud. Like, she still does all of that, even though she doesn't have any power. Meanwhile, Benedict is just kind of, like, shrinking into the shadows. Like, what is he doing? And that's something that I really like, that she's just like, yo, do something. Anything.
Right. She brings up Lady Whistledown, right? Because at this point, Eloise starts building kind of this obsession over
Lady Whistledown.
And, like, she admires this woman who writes and does her shit.
Yeah.
And she says, you know, Lady Whistledown, she's a woman and she has nothing, yet she writes. You literally have everything as a man. Be bold.
Yeah.
This leads him to think that she's Lady Whistledown. Like, hey.
And she's like, no. And even if I was, I wouldn't tell you.
But this is a question that continues to linger. It lingers in the books.
Yeah.
And it lingers in the series amongst a lot of the characters, even after we do realize who Lady Whistledown is.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, our oldest brother, Anthony, is visiting Sienna.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And she shuts that shit down. She's like, you let me go. You need to go be a lord. I don't fit in your life.
Scram.
I'm the woman you love by night, never in the light of day. Leave me alone. I will figure my shit out.
Yeah. Like I've done this entire time. I'll figure my shit out. These women don't necessarily live entirely outside of polite society. They're on the fringes of it because they still interact with the Tan. Sienna performs for the Tan as an opera singer. Madame Delacroix supplies them with their dresses as the modiste. So they're interacting with these people on a regular basis, but it is understood that they are second or third class, where the people of the Tan are first class.
I mean, and you get this scene where Sienna comes up to Madame Delacroix's like shop. You know, they include this scene because you kind of see the comparison that they're making to these debutantes, right? And how they, as working women, criticize those women. You don't want to be simpering around doing your needlework or whatever these debutantes do to pass the time. So here you see a critique the other way, where it's kind of, no, we make our own way in the world, and they're proud to do that. But this is also showing how this restrained society is also a disservice to the men.
Patriarchy serves no one.
Exactly. I mean, he just hasn't found out it's not just about horses yet. So it's like, no,
I was really into patriarchy when I thought it was just about horses.
Anyway, yes. And it's like this sense of not just duty, right? Right? Because you're still going to take care of your responsibilities regardless of who you love and who you have sex with. But it's this, it needs to be with this type of person because you need to carry a title and because your family needs to, because, you know, all in service of this hierarchy that this society has. It also affects how men are able to live their lives, who they're able to love, and how they're able to express themselves.
So, you know, that night we go to yet another ball. It's just fucking balls, like we're inside a pair of pants right now.
Balls to the wall.
Balls and balls and balls. And we see the Duke, who's wearing blue for the first time throughout the show so far.
And I think it's letting us know Daphne's on the dome.
Daphne's on the dome. That's the name of her radio show, Daphne on the Dome. And he lets Lady Danbury know, like, hey, I'm out. I'm leaving the country. I'm packing up my whole fucking house. Like, we're getting out of here. And she's like, you're a goddamn fool. Idiot. Because she knows that he has feelings for Daphne that he's just neglecting.
Well, because I think what the Lady Danbury was trying to do is trying to get him to, hey, dude,
like,
propose.
She wasn't trying to get him to get off the pot. She was trying to get him to shit.
Yeah. Like, hey, do the thing.
Hey, shit. A little bit after they have this conversation, and the Duke is like, again, just standing along the sidelines, like he doesn't participate unless Daphne's there. We see Daphne and Lady Bridgerton make the entrance of entrances. She is wearing this stunning, like, whitish, silverish, like, evening gown. Mm-hmm. Her hair is down in a half up, half down in ringlets, which Paola has called out, was seen as seductive at the time.
This is her letting you know she didn't come out here to play.
Asserting some level of control.
Exactly. She's letting her hair down. She's putting herself out there. And this is how she's taking back some of that control that she kind of let go because of the Duke.
Because she trusted him.
She let herself get distracted a little bit, you know, on what she's out here to do, which is try to marry well.
Marry well and marry someone she likes as much as it's possible. She has this insanely ostentatious feather fan, and everybody like stops talking when Daphne walks in because she looks so beautiful.
It's in slow motion.
It's like high school, the popular girl interrupting lunch.
It is dramatic. You get this slow entrance, and the way the Duke looks at her, it's like, oh shit. It's almost like he's realizing, like, I'm letting this slip through my fingers right now. Because as soon as she gets to the foot of those steps, Prince Friedrich swoops. When I tell you, this man did not hesitate.
He's like, Daphne, can I have your first dance? Cressida can fuck right off.
Bye. And the way they show this, they show Friedrich walking by the Duke, past everyone, to Daphne. She drops her fan. Pretty much, this is a move. She put a move on him. He bends down to pick up her fan at her service. For the Duke, this was the last straw. He couldn't see no more.
He's out.
He's jealous. He's wounded.
And as Lady Whistledown says, why settle for a Duke when you can have a prince?
Fan drop.
You think you the shit? Bitch, you ain't even the fart.
You even fart. She's going hard.
She breaking hearts.
She's breaking hearts. So we get into episode 4 titled An Affair of Honor. Episode 4 opens with tea at the palace. Daphne and her mother were invited to tea with the prince and queen Charlotte's. Hello. The prince and the queen enter, and the prince comes with gifts for Daphne. He buys her a necklace. As he's putting the necklace on her, they do this scene where he's like caresses her neck and she fantasizes that it's the Duke. This startles her, but she's fine. The necklace is fine. Everyone's fine. She's fine. She makes sure she says that multiple times. Later on that afternoon, the prince and Daphne have a little date at one of Will Mondrich's fights. Actually have a good time. They have great conversations. I mean, to us, the prince looks like a pretty good match for Daphne. But she's in love with somebody else. That's the problem. Who else is there? It's the Duke in support of his friend Will. She's out there having a great old time with the prince. The Duke is watching her from across the room. He's supposed to be watching his friend Will fight. He's supposed to be helping him through this fight. And he's too distracted by Daphne and her date. On the other side of town, Portia is trying to get Marina married to some disgusting old guy. The way this man looks at her is gross. It's as if she was a showpiece, something he's buying for breeding. Like, it's gross, it's disgusting. Another view of what women went through at this time in trying to find a good match, somebody who's of money. You know, there were rich old men looking for young women, and this is what some of these young women were put through. Something exciting that happens at the Featherington house is they finally receive a caller for someone other than Marina. While Philippa is getting courted by Mr. Finch, Penelope is out for a walk with Eloise, and Eloise is going on and about how successful Lady Whistledown is and her admiration for her. You know, she says, like, what a life she must lead, what independence she must have. And something that she says to Penelope is, you can be sure that she's not simpering at the edge of a ballroom every night, praying for a man to fancy her and leg shackle her to marriage. Through this discussion, she makes up her mind that she needs to find out who Lady Whistledown is to see if she can offer them advice on how to live a life like hers, be a writer, and do what she wants. This is what Eloise imagines for Lady Whistledown. She is a lady somewhere doing whatever she wants with no constraints from society. As she starts investigating, she puts on her little detective hat. She's like, it needs to be a servant because they know everything and they're writing all our juicy secrets down and exposing them to the town. One of her suspects is her head lady's maid of the Bridgerton house. She goes looking through her shit. She gets caught and is like, are you fucking crazy? Like, you're supposed to be smart. We have no time for this. We're working. Matter of fact, I have to go do shit for you right now. When do I have the time to be Lady Whistledown? She gets checked and has to leave with her tail between her legs. We catch up with Mr. Featherington, who's at the gentleman's club. And we get the first glance at him being a gambler. We have not seen Mr. Featherington win one gamble.
You know, gambling addicts, famously lucky. No, gambling addicts, exactly. Stay losing. That's all they do.
What is it, right? Because you would assume that what makes you a gambling addict is being good at gambling and winning, right? And you're like, oh, this is great. I'm winning. No.
No, you're dog shit at it.
Also at this gentleman's club, this is White's gentleman's club, Granville and Benedict meet again. If you remember, Benedict criticized Granville's painting right in front of him without knowing he was right in front of him. Granville asks him, you know, I would love to see your paintings. And Benedict doesn't have any paintings. So he's quite brave to be criticizing other people's work when he himself has not been putting in the work. He invites him to his studio later on that evening. Benedict goes to the studio where he finds a group of men, women, different social classes. They gather, they paint, they draw, they smoke, they drink, they party. I think it's an environment that Benedict hasn't found himself in yet, in like this little corner of society where artists gather to practice their art. And something Granville says to him, you know, I'm a second son. Second sons have the fun. He's able to explore this side of his artistry because he's a second son and has less pressure than the oldest, who inherits everything and has to carry the family name and has to have an heir and yada, 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 the shit that we see Anthony dealing with, right? Second and third sons are more available to follow their passions. And we see this through Benedict and through Colin's behavior throughout the series. One of Anthony's duties being stepping in and taking the role of what have been Daphne's father, right? Mr. Bridgerton. He's now the Viscount Bridgerton. So the prince comes up to him to ask for his permission to propose to Daphne. Anthony delivers the news. Daphne is not as happy as you would think. She is actually pretty unsure. Violet is trying to convince her to hold off because she feels that the Duke is going to bring a proposal any minute.
First of all, you know this is a TV show because any other time in history and life and reality, any person would have been like, oh, I am bummed that the Duke isn't proposing to me, but the prince? Yes. Tell him I said yes. Yes. Like fucking.
100%. And I feel like had this proposal come a month prior, yeah, there would have been a hell yes. But I think Daphne's gotten to a point where she's developed these like deep feelings for the Duke, with her mother pushing for her to wait for the Duke's proposal before answering the prince. Daphne finally confesses that her and the Duke had a ruse the whole time. It was not real. And this makes her really sad and very upset. Mom, Violet, she knows. She sees like, okay, you guys think it was a ruse. That shit was not a ruse. Mm-hmm. She knows her daughter is in love and her heart's broken. That night, the Duke is getting ready to leave town. Lady Danbury goes to say goodbye and she tries to talk him out of leaving and to follow his heart. She understands his trauma and that he struggles with accepting love from others, but she tries to assure him that love conquers all. You know, and here's where you get the first hint, really, in the series that race was a distinction in this society at one point, because she goes on to credit the love between the king and the queen as the reason why they are in the positions that they are. She goes, look at their marriage. Look at everything it is doing for us and allowing us to become. You know, we were two separate societies divided by color until the king fell in love with one of us. It doesn't give you much history, but it does let you know that this society was segregated at one point.
Yeah, white people weren't just organically cool in this alternate universe. White people need to be strong-armed into most things.
Yes, exactly. And this happened rather recently for their time, but the time has passed. You're at a point where it's barely even brought up, but this happened during Danbury's youth and during Queen Charlotte's youth. So you can imagine it's been 30 or 40 years.
Yeah, guess what, right? Else happened?
Almost a generation.
Guess what else happened relatively recently back here in the real world in society? Brown versus Board of Education. The desegregation, yeah, of American schools at the federal level.
That's right. Ruby Bridges is my mother's age.
Correct. Laws against interracial marriage being overturned. That didn't happen until the 60s. Most of our parents are older than any semblance of fruit from the civil rights movement or any semblance of racial equality in the United States. So that's like so fun to think about. And I think that's how they contextualize it in Bridgerton, kind of a similar amount of time.
Exactly. That kind of places us in a similar position to Simon and Daphne, mm-hmm, being an interracial couple and being able to have this love story and be celebrated, versus in Lady Danbury's time, that wasn't a thing. It was just starting to become a thing. It was just starting to be welcomed in their society. Mm-hmm. Because of that, for him, he's not as optimistic. The way he sees it, he says that remains to be seen. The way he sees it, that happened on a whim. Mm-hmm. That happened, like you said, because a man fell in love with somebody else. And now because they were king and queen, that granted this lifestyle for many people, that can be just as easily taken away. Mm-hmm. That whim can go away. And he compares love to that whim, right? That may change from one day to the next.
And looking at the United States currently, only because that's where we live. I know this story takes place in England. I'm going to keep doing this. I always take the media that I consume and contextualize it in my current life. But he's totally right. So the Duke tenía razón, because living in the United States right now is some absolute bullshit for anyone who thought we were making progress in any social aspect of daily life.
Right. And that's how Simon feels right about now. you know, and this is also coming from someone who grew up in a fickle household. He knew his parents to have a fickle love. He knew that their love was transactional.
Love is a big word for the relationship his parents had, I think.
Right. It wasn't even love. Yeah. It was a transactional relationship, you know, and based on what he and his mother were able to provide for his father, right? His mother to provide an heir, and he has the son to provide this perfection of deserving this title from his father, you know, like that was the type of love he was shown. You needed to be perfection to be able to deserve it.
And as you watch Bridgerton season two, but especially as you watch Queen Charlotte, his father is a piece of shit. Like, you never lose the understanding that his father's a piece of shit. But when you watch Queen Charlotte and you realize the way that the writers of the show have decided to construct the background of their society, like have decided to do a little more world building, you acknowledge the actual precarity that his father is manifesting onto his son of like, if I don't have a son, this shit is going to be taken away from us. Like, that panic, that, like, very legitimate fear infiltrates this person who already sucks, like, who was already pretty terrible.
Yeah.
And it makes him even more terrible. Parts of it make sense. Like, again, it doesn't rationalize his behavior, but it rationalizes his fear.
No, 100%. And then we understand a lot of where Simon's coming from, where he's like, I refuse to repeat this cycle, and I'm going to do it the only way I know how. So that night, we get to the Trowbridge Ball. This is the big ball of this evening. The styling of this ball, you know, something that stands out to me is Sienna's costume.
Yeah, she looks very cool.
She's got like kind of like this corset leotard on. Mm-hmm. And she's just like in these fishnet tights. And I mean, she's got these amazing legs, like it's good legs for days. And the way she stands there and sings and owns her presence, and Anthony cannot take his eyes off of her.
Mm-hmm.
Mom notices this and tries to get like gentle ladies in front of him. No.
Yeah, that shit don't work.
Also at the ball, Cressida confronts Daphne for taking, quote unquote, the prince from her. Girl, ain't nobody take nobody from you. That prince left. That prince was like, excuse me, and moved you aside because we all saw that happening in the last episode. Come on now. And Daphne answers with like, the man made his choice. What am I supposed to do? Hello. And he's a prince. What am I supposed to say? No, you're already courting Cressida.
Yeah.
Bitch. You know, but I think this also shows you how hard it was at the time to be able to have a sisterhood. This marriage mart, right? This society really created a air of competition amongst women. Think about all these young debutantes and then the number of eligible men at the time. You're just fighting for the attention of these men. So it really didn't make for a good friendship or good sisterhood at this time. And you see that play out through Cressida Cowper. She sucks just, I mean, as a person. Either way, the ball is balling. You know, we see our girl Penelope again on the sidelines. And we get a glimpse into how Penelope's mind works a little bit, where she starts joking around with Colin about Lady Trowbridge's baby. She just had a baby, even though her husband passed away during her pregnancy. Mm-hmm. And she's noticing how much this baby resembles her footman. So, as she's bringing this up to Colin, Colin's like, what a barb. And they have a laugh about it. I think she surprises him a bit with this observation as well as the viewer. You're like, oh, okay, Penelope. She's got the tea. She's got some hot goss. And I think that's the first glimpse you get of that from Penelope. Like exactly what she does when she's on the sidelines of these balls. She's got her eyes peeled. She's paying attention. Colin sees Marina while she's talking to Penelope and goes off to try to dance with her, leaving Penelope mad. In this scene, Penelope's wearing her iconic yellow. Most of the time we see Penelope, she's in this bright yellow. And they always have a floor print, and her attire always have some resemblance of butterflies somewhere. The first time we meet Penelope at a ball, she had a yellow dress with a big butterfly embroidered in the front. This time she has butterfly clips in her hair. So throughout the series, where the Bridgertons are represented by a bee, right? Like there's a bee on their door. Sometimes you see the men will have like a bee motif or print on their clothes. The Featherington symbol is a butterfly. And so you see this throughout Penelope's attire, along with her florals and bright, bright yellows and pinks.
Yeah, the yellow could not look worse on her, honestly.
Yeah.
And that's on purpose, because that's specifically called out in the books. The Featheringtons are supposed to seem tacky and less refined. And it's not even necessarily that they're new money. They're just not supposed to be the cool old money. The Bridgertons are the cool old money.
Right, right. And Lady Featherington is very proud of her eccentric styles, as she self describes it.
Yeah.
So that's just her taste. And she puts that onto her daughters to their disadvantage. Because people really do judge them for how they stand out. And also, I think when the costume team were deciding what colors to use for Penelope, like they had her, I think, stand for hours while they tried different swatches on her.
And it's always like citrus yellow. So like, you know, like a blue base yellow rather than like a red base yellow. So it goes green and it just makes you look sick.
And in Bridgerton, we can get like this bright citron yellow, right? But if you're going by the time the books are representing, it's probably like a whipped egg yolk yellow, right? Because you couldn't get these bright tones at this time.
Like we associate that time period with like, oh, earthy colors or pastels or like pale florals. It's like, yeah, we associate that time period with those colors because there was only so much you could do with natural dye on natural fibers, and they didn't have synthetic fabrics yet that can hold on to significantly brighter, more technicolor type of colors
or synthetic colors,
period. Yeah.
So Penelope, she's in her feelings about the Colin and Marina situation, because she's seeing that they are spending a lot of time together. When they're talking about trying to get Marina married off, because she's literally pregnant and maybe has like 6 months before she has this baby, they're trying to get her married quickly. You know, she keeps rejecting these older men who are looking to have a quick marriage for spending time with Colin. Penelope is starting to see Marina's vibes. She's trying to get Colin to be the one to be with her. Colin is a nice guy. He's a gentleman. He's funny. He's handsome. You know, for Marina, that's the lottery right there. If she can get Colin to marry her and be able to raise this child with Colin. So later that night, that's exactly what Marina expresses to Penelope. She says, you know, Colin would be perfect. And Penelope's like, bitch, excuse me? What? No, not Colin. You know, she really gets upset. And right at the moment where she hears this, Eloise comes knocking at Penelope's door, wanting to share some exciting news about her new Lady Whistledown theory and discoveries. And Penelope could not care less. She is stressed out. She's like, the love of my life might be entrapped by my cousin. I don't have time for your bullshit, Eloise. I don't give a fuck who Lady Whistledown is. I'm a woman now, and I have more important things to worry about, like marriage. To where Eloise is like, marriage? You don't want to get married. Penelope spits back to Eloise, not everyone can be a pretty Bridgerton.
Yeah, this is one of the moments I like Penelope the least.
I get her, though.
I also get, we've all had a prettier, like, more privileged friend. Like, we've all had that friend who's like, oh, wow, life is hard. And you're like, bitch, if you don't shut the fuck up. And so I get it. Like, we've all been where Penelope is at.
So here's Penelope doing this thing that she has to do. Her mother's making her do it, right? Because she did ask at the beginning of the season.
Can I like, not?
You know, what if I, can I not? She knows she's not desired.
Yeah.
She goes to these balls to spend her nights literally just standing on the outskirts, you know, watching people. Nobody pays attention to her. So she's enduring all of this, probably embarrassed and a little ashamed. And then she has to go to her best friend, and her best friend's talking shit about everything that she's being made to do. So it's almost like, you're not even out here. You're not even out here with me. Like, you're not. What the fuck are you complaining about?
Yeah.
Like, like, you're complaining about it in theory. I'm actually out here, y tengo na.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think Eloise at any point considers Penelope's position.
Mm.
Or considers that maybe the shit that she's talking is making her feel bad.
Yeah, you right.
Back at the Hastings residence, where Simon is packing up his shit to go, Simon comes across the painting that Daphne and him were observing at Somerset House. The painting that used to be his mother's favorite, that Daphne spoke so eloquently about, and where they shared like this intimate moment. And he thinks back at this interaction with some longing. And you're like, oh my God. When we cut back to the Trowbridge ball with Prince Friedrich, and he's starting to try to declare his feelings while they're doing this dance, and he's trying to have this conversation with Daphne, she gets a glimpse of the Duke in the crowd of the ball. She short circuits. And as the prince is quite literally trying to propose to her on the dance floor, she leaves him plantao and it goes, I have to go refresh myself, and turns around and leaves him on the dance floor
running. Also, again, I'm going to say a couple things because we can all see where this is going. I'm sure all of you have seen Bridgerton. And if you haven't, we know where this is going. But like I've said it before and I'll say it again, okay? Justice for the prince. Justice for Lon Hammond. Justice for the men who are better than the men that our heroines end up with because they're dumb and have bad taste. Justice for these men. I never ride for men ever because men are garbage, except Lon Hammond and Prince Friedrich.
So she runs out of there to quote unquote refresh herself. And does she get refreshed? Ooh. She runs outside to the garden. So real quick, the garden scene were filmed at Hatfield House.
Okay.
These gardens date to the 17th century.
Like the 1600s? Damn.
Now, these gardens are on the grounds where Queen Elizabeth I grew up.
God damn.
So the property and the gardens on these grounds were built by Robert Cecil, who served as chief minister to King James I. For our Mary and George fans, King James gifted the estate to Cecil after inheriting the throne. And the 400-year-old home still remains in the Cecil family till this day.
God damn.
Hell yeah. And it's there you can actually visit these grounds. Fucking beautiful. Pretend you're Daphne and the Duke hiding in the gardens.
But there are no advantages between white people and people of other races. Their family has only owned that home for 400 years. I'm so angry. Okay,
well, you know, you're also talking about like British court and
British court.
They insist on keeping the monarchy and the hierarchy that comes with it. So
go on. I'm mad. Go on.
So Daphne runs into these beautiful gardens that have been there for 400 years, looking like she might have a fucking panic attack. She has this necklace that the prince gifted to her at the beginning of the episode, and she quite literally rips it off and like leaves it somewhere. Can I tell you how many times I've seen this scene to figure out what
happens
she did with the necklace?
She leaves the necklace.
Who knows how much this necklace is worth?
Stop it. Because I saw it again as I was rewatching and I was like,
and I'm like, did she just leave the necklace there?
She sure did.
She definitely did. Oh my God. As she's trying to catch her breath, Simon appears behind her. This motherfucker, after ghosting her, shoots her a little emoji like, hey, just wanted to say goodbye, see how you doing.
I'm weak.
If you don't get the fuck out of my DMs, he's there just to say goodbye. Daphne, understandably so, is pissed. She's like, why are you here? Why are you talking to me? I don't care what you're going to do. Didn't you say you're leaving? Bye. Leave. He won't say a word. He just stands there. So something they don't really go into a lot in the show, but this is played as part of Simon's character, is like he has this pause when he's angry or emotional. If you've read the book, you understand that this is due to his stutter that comes back during like emotional moments or excessively stressed moments. Although Reggae John Page leans into this when he's playing Simon. They don't make it very clear that it's because of his stutter. In the show, you understand he's over that. Struggled with it when he was a kid. He's an adult now and he's completely over it. I'm not sure that that's exactly how it happens for people.
I don't think so.
But I think that Reggae definitely leaned into that part of his character and did showcase that pretty well. If you are a fan of the book and you have read the book, you pick up on that. Mm-hmm. As a viewer, you kind of just see it as him taking a minute. She gets frustrated because he won't answer her right away. He kind of just stands there, what looks like speechless.
Buffering.
He doesn't know what to say. She runs into the maze garden by herself. Simon runs after her in protection of her. She can't go in there by herself, right? Because women can't do anything unprotected. He runs after her, continually telling her to stop. What is she doing? What is she thinking? She can't go in there. Mm-hmm. He finally catches up to her and grabs her by the arm. She turns to him, and at this moment, they stop and just look at each other. They're already in this garden, in this kind of refuge between the hedges of this maze. My guy kisses her aggressively. He pulls back, realizing what he's done, and apologizes. This scene in the book, it's so good. This is one of my favorite scenes between Daphne and Simon in the book. To me, I know we poke fun at the book, but I think it's very well written in the book, and it keeps you engaged. And it's a bit it's steamier in the book. In the book, they're going in.
Yeah.
There's kissing for a while. In the show, she leans back in for another kiss and they go ham. As he's hiking her skirt up, Anthony finds them and punches the lights out of the Duke and demands satisfaction for dishonoring and defiling Daphne's innocence. Goodness me, as if Daphne was not a willing participant. The reason that Anthony asked for satisfaction, quote unquote, is because Simon will not agree to marry Daphne, right? Because that's the next step after this. That's what he demands of him. He caught them in a compromising position and tells him, now you have to marry her. You've crossed the line, taken advantage of her, now you have to marry her. And the Duke refuses. He says, I cannot. Something is hindering him from being able to marry Daphne. He won't say what it is. Daphne's beside herself. She's in a situation where she's seeing the man she's in love with and her brother quite possibly fight to the death over her kissing a man. Anthony takes her out of the ball. They head home with the pretense that Daphne has a headache and she's done. Cressida goes up to Daphne. It's like, are you feeling okay? Did you catch a chill in the garden? This bitch knows something. Anthony takes her home. When they get home, they prepare for the duel. Anthony rounds up the brothers. Benedict is going to be his second. Each person in the duel, based on the 10 duel commandments, needs to have a second, a witness on their side. And Simon asks his friend, Will Mondrich, to be his second. Anthony, believing that he might possibly either one, die that night, or two, kill the Duke and have to run away, goes to visit Sienna. Tells her all about it, and this can be their one last night together, or this can be their opportunity to run away and live their lives separately from society. While all of this is going on, Daphne ends up convincing Colin to take her to where the duel is taking place. She does this by letting Colin know, listen, I think Cressida knows what happened. And if she knows what happened, she's going to talk. She's going to expose me and ruin me and our family. So I need to know where the Duke is because I need to convince him that we need to get married. Otherwise, I am ruined. Convinces Colin. Colin and her ride. And she quite literally rides right into the middle of the duel like a lunatic and almost gets shot. She pleads with the Duke to reconsider. Tells him about Cressida and he refuses again. And if it's not the most fuckboy line ever, she says, do you regard me so lowly that you will see me ruined instead of marrying me? And he answers with, it is because I regard you so highly that I cannot marry you. Bitch, if you don't get your fuckboy ass out of here, what is this the equivalent to in modern day? It's not you, it's me.
You're too good for me, yo. I just can't do it. I can't forgive myself if I did anything but hook up with you semi-consistently. You're too good for me and I don't deserve you.
If you don't get the fuck out of here, punch you in the face. So finally, he gives in a little and he says, look, if we do get married, I am not going to be able to give you children. And I can't take that away from you. That's the motive that he gives Daphne as to why he doesn't want to marry her. Because he knows that he's not going to be able to give her children. And that is her dream, to be able to have a family and raise children. And he doesn't want to be the one to take her dreams away from her. So he says to her, I cannot have you make that sacrifice. And he walks away. He says this and walks away because he's going to continue with this duel. In that moment, Daphne declares to everyone, there is no need to continue with the duel. The Duke and I are to be married. Deciding with that, her fate and his fate. So now, for the rest of the next episode or two, or maybe for the next episode, there's this feeling between them where Daphne feels that she has entrapped him for her sake, and he feels that he has entrapped her by putting her in the position where they have to get married and now she can't live her dream. She won't have a love match. She won't have children. That's the way he sees it. And this creates this awkwardness between them and this lack of communication for the next episode that is so frustrating, because you know, as the viewer, that they both have the same feelings for each other and they're like refusing to talk about it.
I think it reminds you how young Daphne is. The Duke is older, but men are stupid and we don't expect much from them. Daphne's like 20 or 21. Like, she's a baby.
Right.
If anybody with legit emotional maturity should be the one sorting out what's happening between them, it should be the Duke, but it's not. He's almost more emotionally hampered than she is.
Correct. Especially when it has to deal with love and marriage, as we know.
All right. So wrapping up episode 4, that brings us to the end of part 1, if you can believe it, of our recap of Bridgerton season 1. Part 2 will recap episodes 5 through 8 and round out the end of season 1 before we move into recapping season 2.
Woo!
Thank you so much for joining us. We hope you come back, recap Bridgerton season 2 with us, hang out, maybe even for a little bit of a sprinkle of Queen Charlotte, and join us as we live watch and react to Bridgerton season 3.
Hey, hey, hey.
Thank you so much.